Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
President Biden, President Biden, President Biden, Mr. Blinken, Mr. Blinken, can you hear me? Prime ministers and presidents of the European countries, can you hear me? Can you hear the screams from Shifa Hospital, from Al-Aouda's hospital? Can you hear the screams from innocent people, refugees sheltering, trying to find a safe place, being bombed by the Israeli attack forces this morning inside the hospital? Hospitals that are the temples of humanity and protection. When are you going to stop this? You're all complicit.
Welcome to Free State, everybody. This is the first of two parts this week. And we're here. Joe is here. And we are going to talk about a subject that it's hard to get away from. I will say that just before we started recording, I found myself locked in my bathroom and unable to get out. And I thought, this is good. We don't have to record this podcast today. Because it's not a subject that, it's a subject that I think is becoming increasingly, it started at a, it's always been an emotive subject, but it's something that is becoming more and more polarizing and more divisive, as we've seen in stuff that isn't even around the actual issue, but like the kind of the culture, not in the culture war, but the way Suella Braverman stoked things up in the UK, the marches, the counter marches. It seems to be an issue where tribes are flourishing, and there is very little ability of people to just are not. No, I think it's generalization to say little ability of many people, but there seems to be a lack of humanity for many people when you go on social media, and maybe I just sort of have a stomach for it, but it's something.
Well, maybe Dion, it's a very understandable reaction because of your very close friendships with people from the Jewish community, and you know your closest friend being Jewish, and no doubt, it's a very frightening and uncertain time for Jewish people around the world.
But I think it's an issue where, and I don't even mean it from that perspective, Joe. I just mean it in general. Like when I've actually taken like Twitter off my phone because every time I go on, I find it's just extremes and arguments and exhausting blind alleys that have nothing to do with the real heart of this matter, which is what's happening in Gaza. And again, and again, and I, And then also, and what happened on October the 7th as well, and the hostages that are still there. But I think the absolutely exhausting tribalism of it is dangerous in some ways.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, I'm conscious of what the head of the United Nations Human Rights Commission, Muhikber, said during the week. He said, you know, when he resigned because of the failure, he thought of the United Nations to prevent this in Gaza. He said that, you know, when the United Nations criticize any other country for human rights breaches, you know, or for war crimes, you know, we were able to do that. He said, but we can't do that in relation to Israel. You know, Israel is protected and Israel can essentially do what it likes. And I was struck by something that Dr. Mads Gilbert said this week, who's the consultant in emergency medicine who works in rotation. You know, he's a long-standing humanitarian. He's worked in the Al-Shifa Hospital for 16 years. He said that, and it exemplified for me the success of Israel's war on truth and how meaning, you know, and truth has been corrupted. He said that the Palestinian people are the only people on earth who need to prove that they are dead when they are killed. This is the same Mads Gilbert who, just before we began to record today, made a heartbreaking appeal to the international community. You know, he said, like, listen to the screams. You could hear the screams in the background in Al-Shifa Hospital as the Israel Defense Forces attack it again. He said, these are temples of humanity and protection. For God's sake, can you stop? Can you stop this? And, you know, I think that part of the purpose, part of the success of Israel is protection by Western countries, you know, Germany, the UK, the US, the long-standing guilt of Germany about the Holocaust, is that they feel that they cannot criticize Israel. I mean, Germany are now back in the genocide business. I mean, this week they announced that they were going to increase their armament shipments to Israel from 30 million euro last year to 330 million this year. You know, more weapons of war to continue the onslaught on a defenseless population. And I don't know if you saw the famous Jewish comedian Alexei Seal's remarks about this. And, you know, it's very striking. And I think it's very important to distinguish between the Israeli government and Israel, you know, the Zionist Israel, and Jewish people around the world. I mean, Alexei Seal said that, you know, Israel is like a teenager who's never been given any boundaries, endlessly indulged by its doting parents, the West, and as a result, it has now become a psychopath.
So what was your initial response to the recent sort of escalation of attacks from Israel on Gaza? What did you see it as?
Well, I was trying to think of, like, the psychology, really, of the psychology of the nation and the psychology of the people behind it. And I said in 2009 during Cast-Led that, you know, Israel seemed to me like a kind of a teenager that's never been given any boundaries, that is endlessly indulged by its kind of doting parents, the West, and has, you know, kind of become a psychopath as a result, that it's clearly doesn't care about damaging the lives of children. It thinks that everybody else is in the wrong and it is endlessly in the right. And also, it's a state that's endlessly, again, indulged by the power, by the Western powers, by governments everywhere, because they're frightened of it. They're frightened of it physically in some ways. They're frightened of its kind of anger, and they're frightened of the kind of power that it wields, you know, and its influence.
Doesn't care about damaging the lives of anyone, children, women, it doesn't make any difference. They think that everyone else is in the wrong, or they're always in the right, and they're endlessly indulged by Western powers. Because, and this was for me the most fascinating thing about what Alexei said, and I know that he's been very prominent in these peace protests. He said they're endlessly indulged by the Western powers. He said, I think because they are frightened of Israel in some ways, of its crazed anger, frightened of the power it wields now that it's a nuclear power, its power around the world and in the Middle East, and where that might lead to. And I have to say, I hadn't thought of that before, Dion, that the Western powers in some way fear what this sort of, for me, out of control rogue state is truly capable of, and that, which caused me to lie awake last night thinking about this, as I've been doing since, you know, over the last 4 weeks, that maybe what's happening with the Biden administration, what's happening with the European Union, is a part of it is a fear that if they're not in some sense helping to control Israel, that Israel could go out of control altogether with results that simply couldn't be known. You know, it was something that I hadn't thought of.
It's been striking how Netanyahu and the Israeli government, and you know, even the ministers who are far worse than Netanyahu in the Israeli government, how they have spoken about this and how they have demonized the Palestinian people, like in a way that is if you're making a case for genocide, and genocide rests, as you know, on intent as much as anything, you wouldn't need to go far to gather evidence from the comments of ministers and Israeli politicians to support that.
I think God is with them somehow.
I think in a strange way that that sense of being like being on their own, being always like what happened on October 7th just tapped into so many of the sort of darkest fears of Israeli people and the Israeli state, and then the, you know, Jewish people around the world, and it is tragic that again they feel abandoned, and you know, and I would say Israel. Let me finish the point. Jewish people feel abandoned, and I think part of that is because of. Like that is on the Israeli government as well, because their actions have been over a period of time have made people, feel that way.
You look at, for example, how stark, you know, the Israeli ambassador and the second in command, and how they've been behaving in Ireland over the last 5 weeks, which is truly shocking, and that must be in itself very frightening to Jewish people who are accepted and loved in Ireland and are very much part of the community. I mean, the only anti-Semitism that I'm aware of in Ireland in relation to the Jewish community is that very small but burgeoning hate movement, you know, who talk about the Jewish replacement theories and all the rest of it. I mean, but let's go back to, I mean, I don't know if you read Max Hastings.
Yeah,
the editor of the Telegraph, who sort of in a way was responsible for the inexorable rise of Boris Johnson. he was the first person to give him the big job in the Telegraph when he was the editor of the Daily Telegraph. And Max, as you know, was a very prolific writer and scholar, and he in the 70s was recruited by the Netanyahu family to write an official biography of Benjamin Netanyahu's brother, Yoni. Mm. And in that memoir, Hastings recalled, you know, he sets out a really frightening conversation at the dinner table, which he recorded, which demonstrated Netanyahu's ambition for genocide and ethnic cleansing. I'll just read the passage, and this is from the book. At Bibi Netanyahu, that's Benjamin Netanyahu's dinner table in Jerusalem, I listened with crawling dismay to Bibi talking about the future of his country. In the next war, he said, if we do it right, we'll get all the Arabs out. We can clear the West Bank, sort out Jerusalem. He joked about the Golani Brigade, the Israeli infantry force in which so many men then were North African or Yemenite Jews. They're okay as long as they're led by white men, he grinned. And it was a frightening glimpse into this utterly amoral authoritarian figure who is now in charge there. And, you know, the one of the striking features of all of this is the fact that you talk about, you know, people being divided against each other. And how effectively Israel and its sort of very, very powerful propaganda sort of lobby units throughout the world, which I want to talk about a bit, has taken the focus away from the mass murder of civilians. I mean, I was in, as you know, I'm one of the council in Stardust. And I have to say, I feel very privileged to be instructed on behalf of 10 of the families, you know, 48 young people burned alive in a disco in 1981. And on Thursday, I witnessed one of the patrons who survived, Deborah Osborne, give evidence. And she said, you know, it was the heat that hit me first, a terrible heat. I fell. I remember the fear, the terrible fear. You could have heard a pin drop, you know, in the courtroom. I remember thinking, please let me see the sky again. Please let me see my mother and father again. On the ground, I started to go to sleep. I fought so hard and then I gave up because there was nowhere. I couldn't go anywhere. I thought I was going to die. I wanted to live, but I knew I was going to die. I was holding Paula's hand. Then I let go. I shouted and shouted my friends' names. Then Mary Heaney found me. She pulled me. I crawled a few feet and there was a whoosh of air. I crawled towards it. I was barely able to crawl. I crawled outside and stumbled to the grass verge. I couldn't believe it. And the Paula that she describes died in the fire. Her two close friends, whose names she was crying out, Sandra Lawless, Paula Lewis, they both died. And Mary Heaney saved her life in an act of conspicuous heroism. And when she was given evidence, she said, you know, I'm sorry about the way I speak because the lining of my lungs was destroyed. I was so badly burned. I have constant chest infections. She sounded like a very heavy smoker. And the tears ran down her face when she gave the evidence. And it's a constant reminder to me in Stardust how precious human life is. And it's a very scary signal, I think, that Israel has been so effective in taking the focus away from the mass murder of civilians. And, you know, what you say, and I know that you're a person of absolute integrity and good intent, that you're worried about talking about it, you know. And I think that's the game, to get people worried about even talking about it, so that we've got leaders in the Western world, no doubt people of good intent and good faith with families who understand the world and that we're in essence, you know, we're all the same. And yet they're saying things like, well, I stand with Israel. Because it's easier to say that and to start the sort of the deluge of the, you know, the attack dogs that come on to you. I can't remember a time in life, I think possibly during the hunger strikes, when I felt so depressed about the world and about where things are heading.
Really, like in the depression is clear when you see the like footage coming from Gaza, like every hour, there's horrific footage, and we will talk about the attempts like by, you know, Israel and its associates to kind of to discredit a lot of those videos falsely. But it's you know, I know what you mean. Like, you even before you get, even once you get past the hurdle of the disinformation, the noise, the total bombardment of opinion, you're then faced with the reality of what is actually happening there. You know, the footage of people being told to leave a hospital and then rushing back in as Israeli soldiers fired on them. You know, some of you can't even talk about this.
There was a girl, the various horrific
stuff that I find it troubling. Like, I, you know, and we come from this from like different points of view in one sense, but also I think different sensibilities in one way too. And even in the frame of reference that Israel is talking about since October the 7th and the right to defend itself and all this thing, which again people parrot as, and we said this way, you know, in our first podcast, that what does that mean? And still you have to ask yourself, what does that mean? Because what does it mean in the frame of reference that Israel says is its right, how is what they're doing, even if you put aside the lack of humanity, the savage loss of human life, 40% of the people killed in Gaza being children, you know, all this kind of stuff, even in the terms that Israel said it is doing this, it doesn't make any sense, because it is making it harder for itself to defend itself in every sense.
Well, yeah, I suppose I wanted to talk a bit about this, about how they have turned reality on its head. I mean, Dr. Gabor Maté, who himself is a Holocaust survivor, he's a renowned sort of palliative care director at Vancouver Hospital. He was there for many, many years. So he understands life and death, you know, a man of empathy, all of that. His grandparents were murdered in the Auschwitz death camp. They didn't die in the Auschwitz death camp, just like all these Palestinian civilians didn't die mysteriously. They were murdered in the Auschwitz death camp by the Germans. His father survived a labor camp, a German work camp. And he was saved by a stranger when he was 5 months old who took him away. And he said this week, this is the worst thing he's ever seen. He said, in a very deep sense, it's the worst thing I've seen in my whole life. He said, like, you know, it's impossible to compare with other atrocities, but what is different about this is that we see this unfolding publicly and Israel is allowed to get away with it. You know, and he talked about how, and I want to expand on this, you know, during the podcast, because I think it's fascinating, how he said the people of Israel's feelings have been conditioned by decades of propaganda, you know, to the extent that now what they say, and he said, like with Netanyahu, for example, he is so false that what he says is not even the opposite is true.
But in a certain deep sense, I feel that it's the worst thing I've seen in my whole life. And it's impossible to compare atrocities. But what is different about this is that I've never seen anything so publicly committed, such atrocities perpetrated on television. And the victims are presented as the perpetrators. And either this spectacle, this obscene, vicious spectacle that we're subjected to is either supported or condoned by the major media and all the politicians, comes out of a culture in which the atrocities of the other side are never called out. No Israeli spokesman, when they talk about their policies, ever asked, do you condemn the pogrom at Hawara in the West Bank earlier this year? Do you condemn the killings of Palestinian children by settlers? Do you condemn the regular attacks by the settlers? Do you understand that the former deputy chief of staff of the Israeli army said that the situation of the Palestinians in the West Bank reminds him of the situation of Jews in Germany? Is this even reported in the Western press? And what he meant by is that the settlers, like the Nazi hooligans, are free to attack the Palestinians as the Nazis, thugs, the brown shirts, were free to attack Jews, and the army and the police not only stood by, they aided and abetted them. Is the Western public made aware of the thousands of Jewish Israeli rabbis and historians and intellectuals who recently signed a document calling the present situation clearly apartheid? Are you aware that the former head of Mossad has said that the situation of the Palestinians under the occupation is apartheid? And so when anybody is asked to speak about perpetrations on the Palestinian side, they're immediately asked to condemn and to denounce and to reject. And yet the daily suffering, crucifixion of the Palestinian people, and including and especially the people in Gaza, nobody's ever called to task. Nobody's ever questioned. And these smooth-faced liars in the Israeli army who would give lessons to Goebbels, Joseph Goebbels, who are masters of propaganda like Goebbels never was. They're allowed to get away with it. Feelings that are conditioned by decades of propaganda, decades of weaponizing the suffering of Jews as a baton with which to beat the Palestinians. You got to get past that. And you have to actually ask yourself, do I really know what's going on? Have I stood 1 second even in my mind in the shoes of the other? Have I tried to understand what's happening to those people? If they committed certain acts that are hateful, what drove them to that hate? Did the Palestinians come to Europe to attack Jews? Or did something happen in their land that made them so desperate? I know what happened to my own people. Nothing that happened to us in any way justifies what's going on right now. You know, with Netanyahu, it's like with many other politicians, turn off the sound. Just listen to their body language. What you're seeing there is a person so alienated from his humanity, so committed to his ego, that, as they say in Hungarian, whatever he says, not even the opposite is true. It's so false, not even the opposite is true.
No, and I mean, one of the things that, I don't know if you got a chance to listen to, I think I sent you Gideon Levy, the sort of the legendary Israeli writer and thinker who's been a sort of senior writer with Haaretz, the Israel paper of record, for 40 years now. And who's the winner of the Sokolov Prize, which would essentially be the sort of the Israeli version of the Pulitzer, and who has been one of the few voices in Israel to try to turn this all around. He said in a speech recently to the Israel lobby, he said, like, you know, we are a seriously dysfunctional and dangerous state. And he said, look, here are the problems. One, we deeply believe we are the chosen people, and therefore we have the right to do whatever we want. You know, never in history, he said, has there been an occupation, a brutal, cruel occupation like ours of the Palestinian people, where the occupier has presented himself as a victim. You know, and this enables all Israelis to live in peace, because we are the victims. In Israel, everything goes. And he said, we always use the Holocaust. We use it shamelessly. Anyone who criticizes us, we say, well, what about the Holocaust? As though after the Holocaust, we have the right to do whatever we want. And he went on to say, the most crucial and worst thing about our values is the most dangerous one. It has been the systematic dehumanization of the Palestinians over 80 years. And if they are not human beings like us, then they do not have human rights. And if you scratch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you will find it there. Almost none of us think that the Palestinians are human beings. And he went on to say, you know, he said, I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals in Haaretz. And he said, and I received protest letters from Israeli animal rights organizations. I mean, that for me was the scariest thing.
But there was never in history an occupation in which the occupier presented himself as the victim. Not only the victim, the only victim around. This also enabled any Israeli to live in peace because we are the victims. We say victimization, we say chosen people. When I say victimization, it goes without saying we have to mention the Holocaust and the unforgettable Mrs. Golda Meir that the American jury had exported to Israel. She said once, this unforgettable woman, that after the Holocaust, the Jews have the right to do whatever they want. But the third set of values is the most dangerous one, and this is the systematic dehumanization of the Palestinians, which enable us Israelis to live in peace with everything, because if they are not human beings like us, then there is not really a question of human rights. And if you scratch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you will find it there. Almost no one will treat the Palestinians as equal human beings like us. I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals, and I got so many protest letters from animal rights organizations, rightly so. And this set of beliefs that they are not human beings like us enable us Israelis to live in so much peace with those crimes, ongoing crime for so many years, with losing any kind of humanity, values. I heard today people talk about Jewish values. I must be frank with you, I don't know what are Jewish values. I know what are universal values.
He once wrote in Haaretz that the Israelis treat the Palestinians like animals and got protest letters from leading animal rights organizations in Israel to complain about that comparison, you know. You know, he famously interviewed Ehud Barak, the former Israeli PM. And, you know, it was a very, as would be the case with Gideon. And he said, what would you have done if you were a Palestinian? And Barak said, well, unquestionably, if I was born Palestinian, I would have joined a terror organization to fight against Israel. What else would I have done? Become a collaborator? Accepted this oppression?
Many years ago, I interviewed then candidate for prime minister, Ehud Barak. And I asked him a question which I try to ask in any occasion. Mr. Barak, what would have happened if you would have been born Palestinian? And Barak gave me then the only honest answer he could give me. He said I would have joined a terror organization. What else would have he done?
And that interview caused a scandal in Israel and wholesale attacks on Ehud Barak, you know, who, as you know, could never be described as a dove when it came to the Palestinians. And it's essential to understand. We look at the Israelis and we look at the ambassador and the second in command talking about Ireland funding terror tunnels, and we say, these people are absolute nut jobs. This is insanity. But it's only when you listen to prominent Israeli and Jewish commentators that you begin to understand the culture in which that sort of thing has become normalized. I mean, Raz Segal, Professor Raz Segal, who's many people believe the world's sort of leading expert on the Holocaust and an expert on genocide. He wrote in The Guardian last week, a powerful state with powerful army allies and a powerful army, military and navy engaged in a terrifying attack against Palestinians who are under an oppressive Israeli settler colonial rule, military occupation and siege, is portrayed as powerless Jews against Nazi terrorists. You know, and I thought a really, I mean, I don't know if you saw it during the week, Dion, the Israeli armored car dragging the dead Palestinian behind them with the rope. Did you see that?
No.
Well, on the, it was the 28th of October, the Israeli journalist, this is a journalist, like a prominent Israeli journalist, Stas Kopolo, he tweeted a gruesome video of a dead Palestinian being dragged behind an IDF armored car with a rope, you know, like in the old days in the Clint Eastwood movies, you know, where they would tie, at the start of the movie, they would tie Clint to the horse and ride off, you know, and then leave him there for dead, not realizing that he was going to come and kill all 76 of them in due course. Stas tweeted out the video. He was with the IDF, you know, embedded with them. He tweeted out the video triumphantly. Our forces dragging a dead Nazi killed in Gaza. I mean, you know, and this is what the dehumanization of Palestinians has sort of created. Now, you know, there's no conflict. I mean, Stas' Twitter account has been suspended since, but this is they think normal. You know, they're shooting animals, they're killing animals, and they're murdering animals. And I mean, your man, I'll come to some of these nut jobs who RTE have been given a platform to. But I mean, Benny Gantz, the Israeli cabinet minister, he said this week, did you see this one where he was asked by the CNN reporter? He said, like, you know, there are over 10,000 civilians dead. Mr. Gantz, you know, have you any comment on that? He said, well, that's simply details.
Yeah.
Simply details. And Isaac Herzog, the Israeli president, he said, there are no innocent civilians in Gaza. They're all collectively responsible for Hamas's attack on Israel. You know? I mean, and do you know, I thought of a good way to illustrate how insane all of that is, how perverse it is, by making a comparison with the North during the Troubles. You know, and I thought it would be a bit like the UK government. Now, obviously, we had a wild lot of the features of what's happening. And I mean, certainly in the past, we had, you know, the systematic starvation, the famine, you know, the beheadings, all those things through the centuries. But let's just come to the modern troubles, the 30 years troubles, say from 69 to the ceasefire in 1998 and the Good Friday Agreement. It would be like the UK government carpet bombing, UK military carpet bombing Republican nationalist areas of the North, right? And saying, well, you know, these communities are harboring the IRA. The IRA are living amongst this population. You know, people are going in marches on support of them. They're harboring them, they're sheltering them, you know, they're spiriting them out of the areas to protect them. They're giving them safe houses. These IRA, Nazi, ISIS terrorists are using their local communities as human shields. And therefore, although we will try to avoid civilian casualties, what do you expect us to do? We are exercising our right to self-defense. And then them going ahead, bombing the Royal Victoria Hospital in West Belfast, the Mater Hospital in North Belfast, destroying most of South Armagh. And, you know, that's not as improbable as it sounds, because whenever the archives were opened in 2014, it emerged that the DUP's top team, including MPs William McRae and Gregory Campbell, while the US was bombing Libya in 1986, they requested the UK government to bomb the Republican areas of the North, to carpet bomb them, to take them out. How fucking insane would that be? They'll say, are you fucking joking? Right? But when it's Israel, you've got world leaders saying, Bernie Sanders is supposed to be the man of the people. A ceasefire would be very wrong. It will allow Hamas to regroup. Guys with AK-47s and bicycles and scooters, it would allow them to regroup. And 11,000 civilians dead. And Joe Biden said, imagine that. Imagine what Joe Biden would be saying if that was happening in Ireland in the North. I mean, the Americans would be coming in. I mean, the American troops would be coming here. They'd be in aircraft carriers would be off the coast of Northern Ireland, and it would be stop this fucking now to the Brits. But we've got this bizarre world where you've got doctors from, you know, Medicine Sans Frontières and these, you know, heroic lifesavers going in there, and they're making wee videos on their phone, like, can you fucking stop killing people? I mean, I don't know if you saw this morning, just before we started, one of the consultants from Medicine Sans Frontières, she was begging the Americans to stop this, to help to stop this, and she couldn't continue. She couldn't continue. She had to weep and weep, and someone else had to take the phone from her and resume. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, and the interesting thing for me is that it's only people who've retired. Do you know, like the head of the United Nations Human Rights Commission who resigned last week, and now he's able to speak freely. Charles Freeman, the former U.S. Secretary of Defense, he said this week, this is not a war with Hamas. It's a war of annihilation. There are two objectives: expel Palestinians, or if that doesn't work, murder them. It is a grotesque crime against humanity.
As I said, this is not a war with Hamas. It is a war of annihilation aimed at Palestinians in Gaza. There are two aspects to this, two objectives. One is to expel Palestinians. There's been quite an effort made to get the Egyptians, with American support apparently, to take them into Sinai, which has failed because Egypt does not want a troublesome population in Sinai. It already has enough trouble there. The other objective, if they can't be expelled, they will be murdered. And so what we are seeing is very indiscriminate bombing, you know, killing hundreds in order to aim at one Hamas figure whose whereabouts they have identified. It is ruthless. It is a grotesque crime against humanity. And it is costing Israel, I believe, and the United States, which backs Israel in this, a great deal internationally.
Is there any other way to describe it?
No, I don't think there is any other way to describe it. I think that's the, and again, when you have things like this, will give Hamas an opportunity to regroup. Like that, those kind of comments, again, they make the they do actually fall into that trap of actually kind of portraying the entire population as somehow, you know, complicit and part of Hamas's network in some ways, because like, well, you know, what does that mean? What does that actually mean? And like the point is about this is that everything that, and I think Hamas have scant regard for the people of Gaza, and I think, you know, the point about this is
what that does that mean, Dion?
I don't think
that'd
they care.
Like saying the IRA, that'd be like saying the IRA had scant regard for the Republican people of the North.
Well, like,
who were living under British oppression, being shot dead by them willy-nilly, being put in detention camps, 2,000 in all, put in a detention camp without charge or trial. I mean, like...
Well, I'll tell you what it means, Joe.
That was all fine.
Hold on a second.
Murdering civilians.
I'll tell you what it means.
You know,
it means
living under oppression, being beaten up in our homes, thrown out of bed, having the car ransacked, having the house ransacked.
I'll tell you what it means.
A percentage of the people is going to rise up against that.
No, but it tells you what I'll tell you what it means. It means that when
should we have just accepted it? Should we have just laid down and accepted it?
Joe, you asked me. Let me answer. When it means that when they do something like October the 7th, they don't care. They know who their enemy is. They know how Israel will respond, and they don't care about the consequences of that. Okay, that's what it means. All right.
That's the Israeli propaganda.
It's not
right?
Hold on a second. Don't say when I give an answer, which is I say in good faith that this is an Israeli propaganda.
But that's what they say. Yeah. Well, this would never have happened without Hamas. As though history started on the 7th of October.
No, I didn't say that. Did I say that?
You said they have scant regard for the people of Palestine. I said they wouldn't have done this otherwise.
No, I said.
What do they do? How do they respond to constant, as Gideon Levi, Daniel Levi, Gabor Mate describe as one of the most cruel, oppressive regimes in history. How do they respond to that? Do they just accept it? Do they just continue to live in the shanty towns? You know, eat whenever the Israelis allow them to eat, drink when the Israelis allow water through, you know, have electricity whenever it's at the pleasure of the Israelis to allow them to have electricity. I mean, I'm going to read out a quote to you, and you tell me when this was. I'm going to read out a tweet that was sent by a doctor from the Al-Shifa Hospital, okay? And you tell me when it was. Thank you for your support. They are bombing us. They have bombed the central market in Gaza City two hours ago. 80 people are dead. Many are injured. They have all come here to Shifa. It is Hades. We wait in death, blood, and amputees. Children, pregnant women. I have never experienced anything this horrible. Now we can hear the tanks close by. Tell it, pass it on, shout it, anything. Do something. Will someone please help us? When was that? When was that tweet sent out by a consultant surgeon in Al-Shifa?
I don't know.
That was the 3rd of June, 2009. The 3rd of June, 2009, at 13:50, by Dr. Mads Gilbert, all right? The famous Norwegian surgeon who works in rotation out there.
Yeah. And so what's I don't see how
Do you want another one? Do you want another quote?
No, I don't.
These are the worst things I have ever seen. I have never seen anything like this. The brutality, the disregard for human life. That was during the 2014 carpet bombing of Gaza by Israel, which killed 2,500 Palestinian civilians. That was in response, the Israelis said, to three Israeli teenagers who were horrifically abducted and murdered by Palestinian militants. Okay, the response to that was a 45-day bombing. Okay, and that was from a consultant surgeon, the message that I've just read, in July 2014. Yeah?
We talked on a previous...
The other thing that Israel have done is they have persuaded people that history began on the 7th of October. Okay. When leading Israeli commentators and Jewish commentators around the world are having to stand up and say, look, we are not part of this gross cruelty and hypocrisy. This has to stop.
Yeah.
America has to stop enabling it. Europe has to stop enabling it.
Hold on, there's a couple of things. I'm not saying that history began on the 7th of October. I am saying history got a lot worse on the 7th of October, right? But also, we have talked before about how Hamas and Benjamin Netanyahu were in a perfect arrangement as extremists, right? Okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, and there is no doubt about that. And there is no doubt, and we've talked about, and you see it now, and, you know, the point that you've made before on this podcast about the West Bank being a perfect example of the Israeli attitude, where there is no Hamas in the West Bank. And yet you see what happens there. You see how...
Well, they've killed 200 civilians in the last 3 weeks. 200 civilians in the West Bank.
So that is a point. Like, but when the point I'm making, I still think it is very possible to be like, you see, it is very possible to be totally appalled by everything that Israel have done and are doing, and yet think, well, Hamas is a death cult that stands for the erasure, stands for the destruction of the state of Israel and Jewish people. Right?
Just saying to you, Dion, that it's inevitable that an oppressed people is going to rise up. It is the history of the world.
Just like
the Jewish people who were herded into the Warsaw Ghetto and blockaded in there, exactly like Gaza, herded in there, blockaded in there by the Nazis, systematically starved, systematically deprived of food, of energy, of the basics of life, given out passes to a certain number of them to work as collaborators in Warsaw under German control. And then there was the Warsaw Uprising, you know, in appalling rat-infested conditions. They staged an uprising. And then the Germans came in and exterminated them on the second attempt. Okay. Now, if your point is right, then it was those Jewish militants who staged that uprising who caused the whole fucking extermination. If they had just stayed in there and behaved themselves, you know what? Maybe they would have been able to ride it out. Look, let's just stick with where we are. Maybe 500-600 Palestinians killed every year. Whenever the Israelis decide to bomb us once every 3 or 4 years, maybe we'll lose 3,000 or 4,000 civilians. But look, you know, we're living in these horrific conditions. We don't know from one day to the next whether we're going to survive, you know, whether we're going to have enough food. We're not able to trade. We're not able to do anything.
I think
we're relying entirely on our oppressor. But look, it's better this way. Now, that's exactly the same argument. Look, the Jewish uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto was deeply, deeply irresponsible by the Jewish militants who staged that, and they have only themselves to blame. Now, how fucking insane is that?
Well, that is an insane argument. I don't think there's any parallel at all.
Well, why is there not a parallel?
Because there's not a parallel. I think it's really dangerous when we start making parallels between...
Why?
Because the Nazi regime is... There are no parallels with what happened to
the Israelis. Aren't far off it now.
They're not. They're pretty far. There are loads of reference points. There are loads of reference points in modern history. Well, you know, without having to use one. Which, and I understand why Jewish people find offensive that, you know, people will bring up what happened to them in the context of Israel.
As Gideon Levi says, it is the Israeli people, this Israeli government, and I'm not talking about Jewish people worldwide. We all know about the Holocaust, the worst thing that's ever happened, and as far as I'm aware, in the history of humanity.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
But the revered Israeli cabinet minister, Shulamit Aloni, she was voted in a 2005 poll, the 57th greatest Israeli. Okay. And Shulamit was a hawk, you know. She said it's a trick we always use. This is an interview that she did after she was no longer a cabinet minister. She did an interview which was very, very unguarded. I will play the clip for the listener. It's a trick we always use. It's very easy to blame people who criticize the actions of Israel as anti-Semitic. We just bring up the Holocaust, the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money. And the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong. And they are strong in this country. As you know, they have power, which it's okay, they are talented people and they have power, money and media and other things. and their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong, the identification. And they are not ready to hear criticism. And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
That's the revered Israeli cabinet minister, Shulamit Aloni. You know, I mean, I don't know if you saw Michael Sfard. He's a leading Israeli lawyer and commentator. He was on Peston this week. His legal practice is based in Tel Aviv, but he's a sort of a juggernaut in Israel. And interestingly, because I just wonder how this, you must have to have a lot of courage to do this in Israel. I mean, I'm constantly amazed by the output of Haaretz, for example, you know, that they call it, like they're not saying, you know, they're not going along with the propaganda line. They're saying like, you know, pointing out what a rational, logical human being would point out. But Sfard said this week on Piss, and he said, look, you know, there have been decades of abuse by Israel, decades of abuse by Israel of the sacred fight against anti-Semitism. This Israeli government is exploiting the term anti-Semitism and abusing it by using it in a context that has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. I see it in British politics, in German politics, the fear of criticizing Israeli government policy when it comes to the Palestinians, the horrific attacks by settlers in the West Bank on defenseless people. And people are afraid to talk about it because they're afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism. The bombardment of civilians in Gaza, and people are afraid to talk about it because they're afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism.
You know, your question is the product of years and years of abuse of this sacred fight against anti-Semitism. It's really a sacred and very important fight by Israeli government officials and their supporters who are exploiting the term anti-Semitism and abusing it by using it in context that has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. And I can see it in British politics. The scare of criticizing Israeli governmental policy when it comes to the Palestinians, when it comes to annexationist platforms, when it comes to the horrific things that we see now in the West Bank that no one is talking about, how the settlers have been completely waging raids on the weakest communities in South Mount Hebron and in the Jordan Valley. And people are afraid to talk about it because they're afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism. We know what anti-Semitism is. We know, and there is anti-Semitism, and also now there is anti-Semitism when people are going after Jews for being Jewish and criticizing Israeli policy or Israeli actions is not anti-Semitism.
That's an Israeli human rights lawyer, Michael Sfard, talking this week. You know, and I know that you have tried to get the renowned Professor Avi Shlaim onto the podcast, and hopefully we will get him on over the next month. I mean, he made a speech last week where he said, look, anti-Semitism is hatred of Jewish people because we are Jewish. It is not anti-Semitic to criticize the actions of Israel in relation to the Palestinians. The charge of anti-Semitism is deliberately and disgracefully being used to silence legitimate criticism of this Israeli regime.
I think,
I mean, that's why I come back to your point at the start, which is, and I know this to be true of you, and don't for a second think that I know your integrity is absolute, but it's amazing to me. Like, I'm going in the Lewis every day now, you know, because I'm doing Stardust. People are coming up to me and saying, Jesus, I can't believe your balls. I can't believe what you're saying, you know, out loud. We're thinking that, but I mean, it's, you know, are you sure you're saving them? You're saying, what? What? Genuinely, I mean, like, people congratulating you on the Lewis and as you're walking along in the street. And, you know, like, congratulating you for saying, like, you got to stop fucking mass murder of civilians. You can't do it. It's a breach of international law. And it's a breach of all the norms of decency and morality and what makes us all human. But ultimately, it's deeply corrosive to the people of Israel as well. You know, I mean, and you know, you'd think it was blatantly obvious. And yet we all have to sort of start by, I mean, like, I don't know if you saw those and like, if you said to them, right, because they're all very well educated, they're all Oxford educated, all these spokespeople for the Israeli government and the IDF, etc. And if you said to them, look, you know, do you realize that you are a complete nut job? I'm sure these people who've been given a platform regularly on RT and News Talk would be amazed. Like Elon Levy, for example, he's the senior Israeli government spokesperson and he's been on RTE. In fact, they did a 6.5-minute interview with him during the week, right? And I just checked Elon out. You know, he's a bright young thing. Oxford graduate, went back to Israel then. He said on RT, this is the guy who RT platformed. I've just looked over his Twitter output over the last week. Israel is going to destroy the terror state of Gaza. They are monsters. It's not our fault civilians are dying. We warned them to get out. I pause to say they bombed them as they did. Palestinians, this is a tweet. Palestinians can't handle the fact we're the good guys. This is all Hamas's fault. Now you would say, like, that's completely insane. But they have been, as Gabor Maté says, conditioned by decades of propaganda within Israel to believe that that is correct.
You see, do you know what? I think there's a couple of interesting things when you make the parallel with the North. And that idea, you know, of bombing whole communities, the parallel. As you say, there were people who would feel that that's how they would characterize those communities. That's how they would feel about that. And it is that striking thing about human nature that whatever way Israel feels about itself and that it has persuaded itself that this is the only way it can act to defend itself, which we have talked about before, that this is what
it's
they
not
must do.
Itself.
No,
this
I know it's not. I know it's not. I know. It's not.
And they've been doing this at regular intervals for, you know, since 1948 and particularly since 1967.
But Joe, when you talk,
knowledge of history will tell you that that is so. I mean, they were using chemical weapons in 1948.
But Joe,
whenever almost a million Palestinians were ethnically cleansed.
But Joe, the other thing I just want to ask you about, when you talk about Hamas and you talk about, you know, that this is inevitable when the people are suppressed and, you know, they rise up like that.
It's the history of the world.
It is a history of the world, but also there are moments when like in every situation, the oppressed becomes, an oppressor. We saw it in the Troubles, those moments like Warrington, those bombs, Enniskillen, where things became
atrocious,
and there is a dehumanizing element that kind of, you know, you go, how can you get to this point? Do you not see when you say something like that about Hamas, that is almost inevitable that you're that people
it's not will, almost it is inevitable but it's the history of the world.
But do you not think that you're looking at, there is some agency.
I mean, George Washington was a terrorist. Nelson Mandela was a terrorist.
There is some agency when you're there not to actually go around shooting families, not to murder families.
Human beings do not respond well to chronic oppression. They just don't do it. Like I saw it in my own community.
But Joe, do you not think you
know, they appalling me like a man. To a couple of people who socialized in our house regularly. I mean, one of them, you know what, a very, very good friend of my family's, you know, and moved to Dungiven afterwards after he had served his life sentence. You know, the Coleraine bomb, one of the most atrocious, all atrocious, but I mean, a horrific bombing, you know, killed many civilians. And, you know, and the person who carried that out after he'd served his life sentence is now a valued member of the Dungiven community. It was a horrendous thing, horrendous. You say to yourself, how can someone do that? How can a human being do that to other human beings? Joe. But that is the history of oppression. That is what oppression produces. And we know, you know, we see now the sea change in the North since the peace process and since the Catholic nationalist people were treated with equal respect, have the vote, have equal housing rights, have equal employment rights, all of the things that were denied us, you know, that led to the troubles that began with the civil rights movement. The civil rights marchers are battened off the streets. And then you've got a portion of the people who say once the British come in and start shooting, start killing civilians and then lying about it, you know, then a portion of the people are going to rise up. And it doesn't matter what me or what John Hume or what any of the other people who believe that the only route is peace say. This is the reality of the world.
Yes, you know, the fanatics.
Bernadette Devon said, you punch somebody in the face, they're going to punch you back.
The history of the world is also fanatics.
As usual, you call them fanatics and you call them a death cult. There is no death cult in the Middle East like the Israeli government.
I didn't say there was. I didn't. Yeah.
They have killed in the last 25 years, they have killed 15 times the amount of Palestinians as the other way around. The response to that is to kill, at this point in time, 11,000 human beings in Palestine. And the answer, and Israel's answer to that is, well, look, you know, Hamas are using them as human shields. And I come back to the point, the UK government could have said that about us in the North. We're harbouring the IRA. The IRA are using them as human shields. It's absolutely shameless. You know, don't blame us for this. Blame the IRA. Thanks a million. You know, and I was really taken last night by some reports on CNN where they'd gone into Tel Aviv. And people are on the beaches, they're in cafes, on the sidewalks. I mean, it's a pristine society. I mean, you just wouldn't believe it. These are side by side. And, you know, as David Graeber said, you know, another sort of eminent Jewish intellectual, he said, you know, how can anyone think that this is a war? Netanyahu and the Israeli government do not speak for me and for most Jewish people worldwide. They want to intimidate us worldwide into being silent. We cannot be silent, you know. But I mean, you know, what's right is right here. And I tell you what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to suspend my faculties of disbelief and say, well, look, Israel's exercising a right to self-defense. Whenever I see, you know, a distraught surgeon, I don't know if you saw her yesterday on the BBC, Dr. Tanya Hassan, who's a pediatric ICU consultant who's working with Doctors Without Borders. And she said, there is an avalanche of human suffering here. It is man-made. This is a targeted bombardment. You know, we are not human shields. The Israelis are wiping out entire multi-generational extended families in single airstrikes. And the news narrative almost dismisses this avalanche of suffering. You know, and then she said something absolutely heartbreaking. I don't know if you heard this. She said, we have a unique medical acronym that we use only in relation to Gaza. Did you hear this?
No.
WCNSF. You know what that is?
No.
I can hardly say it. Like, wounded child, no surviving family. Wounded child, no surviving family.
Hmm.
And she said, you know, on the BBC, this is a stain on our collective humanity.
The entire hospital healthcare system collapsed almost a week ago. It was announced on TV for the whole world to see. And in that week, there has been indiscriminate bombardment. And I don't even know if indiscriminate is the right term, because it's targeting healthcare facilities, ambulances, churches, mosques, schools, refugee camps, densely populated refugee camps, wiping out entire families in a second, entire multi-generational extended families in a second. There are almost 1,000 families in the Gaza Strip who have had at least two members of their family, at least two members, killed in the last 3 weeks. There are almost 4,000 children who have been killed and identified, excluding almost 1,000 children whose bodies are still trapped under the rubble. Some of them may be alive for a long period before they ultimately die under the rubble. And I'm sorry if there are any young, you know, children watching this. Perhaps this is a good time to ask them to leave the room. But I think it's important that I paint a picture, particularly when I'm following a news narrative that almost dismisses this avalanche of suffering that is unprecedented in modern times. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an acronym in the Gaza Strip right now. You know, I'm a pediatric intensive care doctor. I see a lot of suffering in my career. There's an acronym that is unique to the Gaza Strip, and it's WCNSF, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. Children, and it is used not infrequently in the last 3 weeks. It was coined in the last three weeks. One physician told me a few days ago that a little girl came in wounded, and she had a piece of paper in her pocket that she handed to him. He sent me a picture of the piece of paper. It had 27 names on it, and she said, "These are the members of my family that were with me in my home. Please look for them. Please look for them under the rubble. Don't look for this one," and she points to the name of her sister. "I know she's already dead." This is a 10-year-old little girl. Wounded Child, No Surviving Family should not exist as an acronym. And to follow President Biden as he continues to justify and to warmonger. All I can say is this has to stop.
They put the interview out, you know, I'm a night owl, as you know, they put the interview out in that sort of BBC rolling news service, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I saw it, you know, but I wept when I saw that, you know. And, you know, this, I don't know if you saw it this week, this small Israeli child, or sorry, the small Palestinian child who had survived a bombing, and she was, you know, she wasn't wounded, but her family were killed in the bombing, and she was so excitedly chattering to the camera because she had saved her books and her education certificates.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "I want to become an engineer." She was chattering, you know, as if everything was fine, holding her book so proudly. If my books were destroyed, my dreams would be destroyed along with my whole childhood. I put them all in my bag to take them with me in case our house got targeted last night. It didn't get targeted, but I saved my books. You know, I don't know if that child's alive or dead now. You know, it was 4 or 5 days ago.
لأنه يعني كانت ترافقني في كل مكان شهاداتي يعني بصف روضة وأول وثاني وثالث ورابع وخامس هاي شهادات وشهادات أخوي هاي أكثر شيء بحبه لأنه يعني المديرة هدت لي إياها صف ثالث أنا بحب التعليم كثير يعني لو مثلا كنت بتدمر وتحطم كل طفولتي وتحطم كل يعني كل اللي كنت أقرأ وأدرسه يعني أنا نفسي أصير مهندسة يعني حلمي بتحطم وحياة طفولتي اللي كانت تلمني في البيت يعني بتتدمر فيعني أخذتهم أنا كنت أقرأ الليلة حطيت الشنط عندي يعني لو يصير ما يصير أطلع أنا وياهم يعني صار يعني اللي كنت أنا مفكر فيه وأخذتهم معايا.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.